This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Let's move over to the Reiners. 4.5 months after Rob and Michelle Reiner were found stabbed to death in their Brentwood home, an autopsy report on how they died still ain't finished. The case against their son, Nick, has now been pushed to September. And it's not a trial. It's not even the preliminary hearing yet. It's a date to potentially set the preliminary hearing. We're getting like close to a year anniversary where we'll get to the preliminary hearing. The defense says it needs more discovery. The prosecution says it's waiting on the medical examiner. Both sides agreed to the delay because you don't have the information. You don't have the information. And Nick Reiner, the man facing two counts of first-degree murder with death penalty eligibility, sat in court, consulted by his public defender, and said one word:
yeah.
So what is actually happening behind the scenes in this case? And what does the pace of this thing tell us about what both sides are building towards? Joining me to discuss, as always, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis. Eric, if you're Jake or Romy Reiner right now, you lost both parents to violence. The person accused is your own brother. And the court just told you, come back in September, 5 months from now, for a hearing that isn't even a real hearing. This has got to be very, you know, devastating emotionally to the family, because from the outside, it looks like nobody's in a hurry to get justice for Rob and Michelle. And I have to imagine the people who love them are watching this timeline and somewhat losing their minds. But that's the emotional side. Emotional side and legal side are two very different things and require very different framework to operate. But a year in for the preliminary hearing, I mean, is this crazy? Is this normal? Give me your thoughts.
I'm not sure I've ever seen such a delay just to get to the preliminary hearing stage. That's like the second step in a case like this, like, among like dozens of steps. So, you know, we're not even there yet. This is a nightmare for these folks that won't end. And in terms of what's going on, it's a bit of a head scratcher. Autopsies can take some time. I have seen them take about this amount of time or so. But especially if this was like a very violent death, like a clear stabbing or shooting or whatever, like usually those conclusions can be drawn rather quickly, and the autopsy, the medical examiner can amend their report later if need be. But delay, which might inure to the benefit of the defense.
Sure. I mean, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, I get you want to cross your T and dot your I. I know that this is going to be a case that's going to be under a microscope. So you really want to be sure you got everything and you can present it. But the method of death isn't really like even up for question here. It's like, we know he did it. It's more so why he did it. And was he in a state of mind where he could be held legally responsible for understanding he was causing the death of someone at that moment? Are those answers to be found in the physical reflection of an autopsy?
Not at all. No. In fact, most medical examiners expressly opine that, hey, not only can I not conclude who did this, but I can't conclude what was going on in their heads. That's outside the purview of their expertise. They can't talk about that. And also, Tony, with the preliminary hearing coming up, even if there are potential mental health defenses, those are rarely even considered at a preliminary hearing. And when they are, the judge usually says, hey, my job is to decide if there's cause for these charges. There might be defenses. There might be things that side can raise at trial. But the scope of preliminary hearing is rather narrow. Is there probable cause? We don't need a full mental health evaluation and all these mental health experts. I doubt they'd even be allowed to testify at the preliminary hearing. So what are we waiting for?
Yeah.
So I'm curious about this one, Eric. I'm gonna flip from the legal side to the maybe a pragmatic side on the human behavior side. Do you think, since you said it will, if it's going to benefit anyone, it's going to benefit defense on this to keep delaying this out? Do you think that, because we keep hearing all the issues they're having with Nick behind bars, and I mean, we're seeing it. He hasn't let go of his victim mentality. He still looks like a super nutter, all these things. Do you think defense might be delaying a bit to try all they can to try to regulate those meds he's on so they can actually potentially, since they know it's going to go to trial unless they plead out, which is another question I have, if you think he's going to do that. But do you think they're trying to make him a more compelling individual by delaying more to try to get those meds regulated out? And the more time they have, the greater chance they have at it? Or is that just, am I just doing too much thought experiment?
That very well could be a part of it. Along those lines, too, there might be some competency issues. And sometimes those are not made public. Sometimes there are private hearings and even meetings in chambers with judges about very sensitive private matters like that. I'm wondering if there might be some ongoing competency issue, because for this guy to be competent and face trial, he has to have an awareness of the charges and he has to be able to materially aid in his own defense. And perhaps defense is saying, hey, we've met with this guy and he's screwed. We're not there yet, but we're not ready to raise competency just yet. Judge, why don't you give us a little more time to work on the meds, to work on the psychological piece of this and try to get this in a place where it can be tried. It's at least possible that those conversations are being had and the public is unaware of them.
Is that a reason why also the prosecution might go along and agree to the delay too, because they want to make sure there's less chance for appeals after that?
I think that could be a part of it. If there was potential competency issues, prosecution doesn't want to convict somebody when there is a question as to whether they're competent and have that conviction come back. So maybe prosecution's like, hey, defense is working with this guy. They've got a meds regimen and they've got counselors who I'm sure he's seeing. And so we'll let them kind of do their thing to ensure that we can secure a conviction and that it remains final at the appellate stage.
My guess is we figured it out.
Well, I mean, give me some insight here on how the sausage is made. I mean, if this is a red herring to the public and we're like, this is the cover story, this is what we're telling the public right now, why not just say there's competency issues right now and we're going to, we need too. Some time to get there. We've seen it in Daybell. We've seen it in a gazillion cases where it's not like, oh, they're kind of out of it right now. Game over. It's like, no, we're going to give him a chance to kind of get back on the saddle here so they can be competent in court. Why not just explain it that way? I mean, is it ethical? Is it even legal to delay the hearing here under a publicly stated false pretense? Does this happen behind the scenes where everybody back in the judge's chambers are on the same page of this is competency, but yeah, we don't have the autopsy yet, so let's just say it's that to the media. Does that happen?
It would be very unusual. But this is a very unusual case. You know, we were just talking about Koberger recently, where a public defender had one of their experts sign an NDA regarding that expert work, apparently. That is extremely uncommon, but the world's eyes were on that case. The world's eyes are on this case.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't, and judges have discretion often to control the proceedings, to maintain decorum and integrity of the judicial institution. There are things that happen what's called under seal. There are things that happen that are just not publicly available. So it's possible. But if defense really did think that their client had competency issues, usually you have an ethical duty to raise that. And then there's a whole sort of parallel competency procedure that you have to go through. So, I would say certainly unusual. It's an unusual case.
But again, it could be possible that, you know, it's a legitimate claim about the medical examiner's report. But since they're seeing, you know, so they can be slow walking that, knowing that the next issue they may have is a competency issue, buying time just because they think it might be an issue. I mean, just listening to Nick makes me think it's going to be an issue.
Yeah, And you know, Robin, I can understand the prosecutor really wanting to have that autopsy report by the time of the preliminary hearing. That is usually a critical piece of a preliminary hearing. And they probably just want to make sure that they have all of this ready to roll, so there are no missteps, there are no outs. That could be a piece of this delay as well.
And he's behind bars anyway. You know, it's one of these things. He's not on the loose. He's not on bail. And he's suffering behind bars. So, I mean, yeah, it's kind of strange.
When is the time for the defense of Nick Reiner to queue up the not guilty by reason of insanity plea? Because right now it's just sitting as not guilty. Under California law, you have to do two pleas. You have to do not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity, two different filings. But they only got the one. Is that something that they are literally waiting for the pretrial hearing to bring that up? Is there a reason to wait for that? Is it more strategic on their part to wait for that rather than throwing that into the ether before the autopsy comes out?
In most jurisdictions, Tony, there is the courts want people to raise issues like not guilty of reason of insanity promptly. It's not something you can just sit on and then like do a trial by ambush thing a few weeks before the trial. And mm-hmm. Like, oh, actually, you know what? He's not guilty by reason of insanity. Now prosecution catch up. Usually you have to raise that quickly, just as you have to do with alibi in most jurisdictions. It's not something you can just sit on and wait. So it's a bit unusual that they haven't raised it yet. I'm sure they have done at least an initial mental health evaluation. And usually that initial evaluation can tell a defense attorney, hey, we have a viable NGRI plea or we don't. Unclear why they wouldn't be in a position to raise that defense if they're going to raise it.
When do you see the deadline for them being able to do that?
It varies by jurisdiction, but you know, I think in Colorado it says something like as early as practicable. And so, you know, if you've had the mental health evaluation and you have grounds to believe you're going to raise a not guilty by reason of insanity defense, you got to do it. There isn't always a hard and fast deadline. Varies by jurisdiction, but it's usually the it's customary to have to do that early on, man. You can't just sit on
that. Is that another reason to delay right now, using the medical examiner's excuse to do that so they could get more time to get that in? I'm just kind of stabbing at the
wall. I think they've had enough time.
You would think.
You know, in cases where I've explored that, we did that within the first, you know, month and a half after the incident. And here we're going on months and months and months. I just don't see a reason why they haven't raised it yet if they believe that it's a valid defense.
I just keep going back to what the hell is taking nearly a year for an autopsy to be performed. I mean, is there that much of a backlog and it doesn't really matter who you are or what's pending? We're just got to, I mean, they got the bodies. This is done. I mean, what more can possibly be needed to have extra time to complete this report? This just doesn't make any logical sense to me. Is there anyone in this case, defense or prosecution, that could somehow put a wedge into this that would be delaying that report in some way, shape, or I don't know the answer to this question, but it's a red flag. It doesn't make any sense to me. And when you see a red flag and something kind of critical is an autopsy, you're like, what the hell is going on here? Why is this? Rather than just accepting, oh, they're slow.
Yeah, no, it's a head scratcher, you know, compared to look at the case of Barry Morphew, right? So Suzanne Morphew, yeah. his wife and the alleged victim in the case, her body wasn't found until at least a year after she disappeared. Yeah. It was all decomposed and the elements had gone through it. You know, and so that's in that case where they had to like go into her bones and try to find this extremely esoteric poison that they claim they found. That's going to take a good amount of time. But when you have a rather traditional means of death that these coroners have experienced, I imagine, hundreds of times, what would be the hang up? Why can't you just issue the autopsy report with the apparent findings? I just don't get it. I don't. Has there been turnover in the office? Has it? You know, I just don't know. It's strange.
I'm curious, did they get Celeste, you know, in the David case, did they get her autopsy and she was like severely decomposed in a bag? What? I think they got hers faster than this. I mean, she was right. a puddle in a bag, in a frunk.
It might be the same folks, honestly.
I know. Maybe they took too long doing hers.
I don't know.
Good point.
And because what are they? I mean, what takes so long in this autopsy? I mean, it's gunshots. I mean, just what the hell? I don't get it.
I hear you.
Yeah, it's a big question, and I think one that deserves an answer. Maybe some more digging there might be a good idea. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to hear from you. Be sure to weigh in. The links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Wake up, San Francisco. I'm Danny Tanner. Welcome to the show today. Happy New Week, everybody. Jake Reiner, we're going to be talking about the Reiner situation here. First, your thoughts. We'd love for you to weigh in out there on the comment section. Jake Reiner wrote about waking up every morning and having to convince himself it wasn't a dream. He put out a new a piece this week. It's the first time he's spoken publicly on his Substack. The article is called Mom and Dad. He wrote about being robbed of his parents at his wedding, of grandchildren they'll never hold. Meanwhile, reports say the brother accused of taking all of that from him is allegedly plotting a revenge tell-all from his jail cell, not to seek justice, not to take responsibility, but reportedly to settle scores with the very people who spent years trying to save him. So when a family pours everything into someone dangerous and loses everything because of it, at what point does the person left standing get to stop carrying the weight of someone else's destruction? That is what we are getting into in our first segment this morning. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, my co-host with us as always. Good morning.
Yeah. Happy Monday. What a busy weekend. Oh my gosh. With everything going on, with everything we're covering. And then in between all that, you know, assassination attempt and everything, you know, Tony and I are going back and forth watching more of our cult specials on TV too. Yeah.
Oh, you know, my gosh. It all comes up to, I mean, everything just comes down to really unhealthy minds. That's where we end up with everybody.
Well, at the same time, though, it helps you appreciate what you do have. You know, every time you watch and absorb and digest what's going on in the world around you, it gives you context to see what is healthy and what's unhealthy, so you know what to attach yourself with, who to interact with, and know what to tolerate or not tolerate in your life. I think that's one of the greatest things about doing what we do is we give some recognition for everyone tuning in to what's right and what's not right when it comes to who should we have in our lives and what we should do about it.
Yeah, 1,000%. We're taking your questions on Substack, YouTube, Facebook, X, wherever you're watching us live. We also have several of your questions that you've dropped on our videos over the last week or two. We're going to try and get to a handful of those here as we work through this live today. But please do drop them. All right, let's just start with this one, the first one. It's something I think a lot of people have thought about when they've looked at this case. It says, I keep thinking about that smirk at the arraignment, speaking about Nick Reiner when he was in court. This is at you, Robin. You study people for a living. What does a guy who reportedly can't process why he's in jail but still wants to write a revenge book actually look like from a behavioral standpoint? Because those two things don't go together in my head. Danielle on Instagram asks that question.
I keep things as simple as possible in all this. I'm not the lawyer. I'm not licensed psychotherapist like our great Siobhan is. So I just break it down into this. That is one broken brain.
Yum.
It really comes down to that. It is a sick MF-er. It really is. And I don't think there's any fixing it. And I know this comes up with one of the questions later. Medications that they keep kept trying with him and are continue to try with him are band-aids for the underlying broken brain. It is an unfixable brain in that head. And so I just think it comes down to that. There is no reasoning with it. There's no having it shift. I mean, we haven't seen it yet. Why would we see a shift in his behavior pattern? Remember, past is prologue with a lot of people. And even though we all learn and we're not the same people today as we were yesterday, you can kind of see those arcs, those trajectories. It's why I always go to behavior arcs and life arcs of people, because people are not going to have these major shifts out of that unless there's some event that they have this aha epiphany. Mm-hmm. And even with an aha epiphany, that rudder starts shifting slightly. It's not like today I'm a horrible human being that is a wound-collecting, victimizing person with a broken brain to tomorrow I have this epiphany. And in other words, it's not a Scrooge moment from Christmas Carol where he has three dreams in the middle of the night and wakes up fixed in the morning. Doesn't happen.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen for many people ever.
It needs to, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, wouldn't that be great if, like, that story actually worked out and people learned from their horrible mistakes of being massive narcissists their whole life, and suddenly they wake up one morning and, like, ah, I'm better.
It's a fascinating thing, too. So we can look at patterns of behavior across society, across everything, to really understand what we can reasonably expect in every situation. Does anyone watching, listening, tuning in, does anyone ever know someone in their life that went from 0 to 100, went from completely broken to the next day they woke up full accountability and fixed? The closest you'll come is to like a drug addict, alcoholic, or something like that that has their rock bottom. Mm-hmm. And they make the decision that they are broken and they're going to save their own lives by going to meetings, getting clean, going to detox. And then the rudder shifts and they stop consuming the horrible things that are destroying them. And they start the first step on their journey to come out of it. And it doesn't go from 0 to, oh, I get it. It goes from 0 to the first step, the second step, and it's days, weeks, months, and years to crawl yourself up out of that mess you created yourself into being a functioning, more healthy human being that can have a reasonable expectation of a great relationship with another human being. But for Nick Reiner, ain't happening. I mean, how many times has he hit rock bottom only to be saved and coddled by others?
Well, I guess maybe that is the question I think that some people have is has he ever really truly hit rock bottom? I mean, there are stories where he was homeless. He's talked about it, but they aren't like, there are not stretches of homelessness, I think, that a lot of people who are homeless experience. Like, he always kind of had a safety net to kind of go back on. It's like homeless light. Tried it out for a little bit, was like, this is a bit much for me, and then wandered back to the shelter of his parents and those who could essentially keep him from ever hitting rock bottom. And drugs were involved in much of Nick Reiner's existence. What's scariest to me about people like Nick Reiner and people not like Nick Reiner, but still have the same sort of pathology and all that, is the folks with the drug addiction and things of that nature. Sometimes, like you were saying, if they can get themselves cleaned up, if they can get on a good path, There can be some paths to redemption. Hmm. What's more scary, the folks where drugs are not involved at all, and this is just how they are. because you remove some of that and the weight that the drugs are having on the brain, and like suddenly things can clear up a bit. When it's like, this is just your normal mode of thinking all the time, that's even scarier. And I feel like obviously drugs are a big part of the story with Nick Reiner, but I think even you take the drugs out of the equation with Nick Reiner, because there were moments of sobriety here, and he was still a very broken person and still very much someone who didn't seem to ever truly take the accountability for his actions.
Isolation, eating crappy food, in jail, no drugs involved anymore.
True.
And
plotting.
He's still the victim in his own mind. No account. I mean, you don't, what other bottom can you hit except death? You know, I think he's addicted to bouncing on the bottom. He just loves dwelling there. I mean, think about this. Besides that broken brain, which I think is unfixable because of people, they paid a lot of money to try to fix it, ain't fixed yet. Mm-hmm. why else continue? He's addicted to being the victim. He loves it. He's thriving in it. Otherwise, why would you continue it unless you're incapable of moving out of it because your brain is so chemical imbalances, malformations, whatever it is up there that, you know, people like Siobhan love to diagnose and can diagnose much more effectively. But again, if they could diagnose it so well, they would have fixed it or made attempts to fix it and it just hasn't worked. Who knows? But it ain't working.
I mean, recognizing the problem doesn't mean you're fixing the problem. You know, you can go, there's a giant hole in the side of the Titanic and it's sinking. Well, if we got it into dry dock, we could cover that up with new metal and make it float. It's already sinking. It's in the middle of the ocean. Just knowing that is what would be the fix doesn't mean you can implement it. And I think that's very true with some people, including Nick Reiner. Another question we have here, Jake said he'd trade, this is Jake Reiner, Nick's brother, said he'd trade every Dodger game and every Broadway show just to talk to his parents one more hour. In that, and I highly recommend reading it on Substack. I restacked his post so you can find it on ours. The link is in the description for Substack. It's a really, heartfelt piece about his parents. So he's talking about all those memories and everything that he shared with them. How do you even begin to grieve people you lost to violence when the person who allegedly took them is your own brother and he's still finding ways to hurt you from inside the cell? That's the question from Rachel on Facebook.
Yeah, I don't know. I think everyone does it differently. To me, I mean, and I've seen this in other cases, and I think I would do it in my own life. You just have to cut him off. I mean, he's not that's not your brother. That's something inhuman in there. It's just, I don't know how it looks like he was this way a very long time, but that's not your brother. That's not a human being. That's someone, it's something that is a toxic cancer in your life. And you just have to treat it like that. You've got to cut it out. You know, some people, and we see this with the cults. We saw it with Amy Duggar when we interviewed her and other family members. We want to give a lot of grace to family, but I always ask myself, why? You know, I mean, seriously, you can really see some really unhealthy, toxic things. And if you keep associating with it, again, there's a choice. It's not right or wrong or better or worse. I can just tell you the impact if you keep associating with it or keep allowing it to infect your brain. And I didn't say infect your brain because that's exactly what it's taking up, that gray matter. It's taking up bandwidth. It's taking up space. You know, if you just regard it as a broken tool that is no longer servicing me, you got to cut it out. Because I tell you what, he's not viewing him as his brother. He's not viewing him as anything but a tool that he can try to manipulate for his own gain, for his own pleasure. Because the only pleasure Nick Reiner is getting, again, pure conjecture at this point, is continuing to inflict pain and discomfort on others. Because what has he done his entire life? Inflict pain and discomfort on others. He seems to enjoy it. Otherwise, he wouldn't do it anymore. Why is he getting it? Broken brain, whatever. But it's... We allow people to infect us when we accept them still in our lives. Just cut that crap out, man. And I'm sorry for him hugely. And I know it's tough for family members, people to do that. But if you keep accepting unhealthy in your life, it's going to be painful. Unless you have the ability to at least sit back and, as I say multiple times a day, watch a show. I can be very close to people, close proximity. I can listen to words. I can have great conversations. But because I assess who they are, what they stand for, and all these myriad of things, their words don't have impact on me because that's their thoughts, their beliefs, their position in life, and it'll just roll right over me like water. No, but now if someone I do feel close to, I mean, like you, Tony, Todd, our crew here, my wife, my family, my kids, what they say, what their opinion matters very deeply to me. I cannot actually take an action in my life without one of these close people in my life being part of it. Mm-hmm. And if you're part of my very tight circle, it's tight. And there's a huge bar of good, healthy relationships that you have to meet to be there. But other than that, I enjoy the show. People got great words. Some have horrible words. I take it all in, assess it, and then it rolls right over like water. Hard to do. Takes a lot of reps. But in order to preserve yourself, because you can't be there for others if you allow people like that to infect your life.
Do you think that, no, and this is me, we're in an interesting place right now in the span of human history. The whole no contact thing with your family wasn't even, I mean, just – 20, 30 years ago. It was like, what? Oh, my God, who would do that? And if you go further back, you can kind of understand why people weren't doing that. It was out of necessity. It was more so like survival. It didn't matter if you had some narcissistic asshole person in your family. If you needed them to survive, you needed them to survive, and you had to figure out a way to make everybody, well, the cogs in the wheel work together, even if some weren't. We're not in a world like that anymore. We don't need all the cogs in this wheel to function, to survive. If you have a family member that's just a bad apple or whatever you want to call them, flat out evil, you don't need them. You don't have to keep absorbing them. But I don't know that we've mentally caught up to that reality yet. I feel like we're getting there. I think it's interesting. Oprah just did a piece on this, a multi-piece on this, about families going no contact and what that means and why people are doing that. Because there's a huge percentage of people that are doing it far more than ever have in the past with family members that have been toxic, people that have decided to stop accepting unhealthy.
Yeah.
Is this just something? Do you think we're going to get better at this as time goes on? Because it's not required, and we're not. I think a lot of people stay by unhealthy out of shame, and by out of guilt. But guilt and shame that are, I think, very much misplaced, that aren't necessarily accurate to the situation. But because we're told we should feel guilty or shameful for telling an unhealthy family member to go away and go over there. I feel like that dynamic is shifting.
I do too, and I'm very excited about it.
Yeah.
We are genetically and biologically coded for group tribal mentality. It's part, like you said, it's part of our survival. Ancient tribal man, if you didn't belong to the close-knit society, close-knit group, close-knit family, the chances of you being able to procreate and pass on your genetic coding was slim to none. Mm-hmm. So we're coded to want to unconditionally accept and believe in and be around that close family structure. But to your point, because society is so evolved with community, with government, with businesses, with organizations, the mechanisms for survival are in place outside of family. Now, family is a great thing to have if it's healthy. What I really like about this is that, and Amy Duggar talked about it when we chatted with her, it's breaking the toxic cycle. It's breaking the cycle internally of the trauma response family that's constantly, because I don't know the percentage, it's very high. I think it's 85 to 95% of child S abusers come from a place where they were introduced to it at a young age, either by a family member or someone close to that family. So that's where you break the trauma cycle. When you break that trauma cycle with healthy relationships, you have to distance yourself from that original family. And then what are you doing? You're aligning with new family. You're aligning with a new spouse, with a healthier spouse. And so then you can recollect the family, and then family can be close again because you broke the trauma cycle. Yeah. So I think it's taking families that were broken for generational trauma, breaking it, because it takes courage, it takes strength, and it takes a lot of effort and bravery to have the courage to break that trauma cycle, that generational trauma cycle, and then start a new cycle with a new family. And then we can actually go back to this. So those great, wonderful family values will allow us to do what? Feel safe, feel seen, feel heard, and be valued by others. But when you're in that toxic generational cycle, it doesn't happen. And I think that's what people are starting to do. They're starting to have the courage because, you know, as detrimental as social media can be and all this online stuff we have, at the same time, it's able to get messages out like the people, like the Jill Duggars and the Amy Duggar Kings that were able to escape the trauma cycles, and, you know, and people that are able to escape FDLS. And even in this situation, brothers that are able to break from toxic other brothers that have destroyed families, that have murdered their parents, you know, break that cycle, get out, move on. And I think that's what's going to be hopefully a resurgence using what could be negative and use it for a positive.
I agree. I think that is, it's a very healthy way of looking at things in a way that essentially has been shunned, I think, in society for a long time. You don't think that way. That you don't even entertain this idea.
Right.
When in reality, that's the way to freedom. If
don't
you
do
want,
crazy.
You
know?
Yeah.
Just don't do crazy.
Just don't do crazy. Make that your policy in life. Don't do crazy. Keep them out. And don't be afraid to say, no, I'm done. I mean, it feels like a lot of life almost, I don't know, in some ways of looking at it, some generations, it's almost like, how long have you known these people? It's life is not a race, and it's not a contest of how long have you had certain people in your life, because at the end of the day, there's no prize for having toxic people in your life until you're dead. You're going to be much more happier by the time death comes if you had exchanged some of those toxic people for healthy people. There's only so much bandwidth you have to give and take out there. Why not spend it with healthy people, not the unhealthy?
So I'm going to give everyone, and I've read, I can't remember what exact book that I read this. I read so many books, but here is exactly the win for life. If you want to, everyone is pursuing a successful life, a happy life. And it's easy to get caught up in the materialism of the world and have someone else define for you what success is, with monetary gain, prestige, title, accolades, all the things that you didn't come into the world with and you're not leaving with. Mm-hmm. So how do you cannot measure success by those things. There's only really one thing alone I believe you can measure success in. And that is how you're remembered, the type of person you are. Do you want to be remembered as this great professional, or you want to be remembered as someone that lit up a room when you came around that corner, that is always there for someone else? And most importantly, the greatest gift you can give yourself and give others, the only thing you'll leave, is what you taught others about how to treat others, how to be present for them, how to be kind, how to have grace, how to do all these things that help others have healthy, strong relationships. That is what success is. That's what the life win is. What are you going to do to inspire other people to live a healthier life so they can pass it on generationally to the people in their lives? That is what's going to move, that's what's going to move our species forward beyond what it is now, with constantly this. Mm-hmm. And why is it this? Because we are constantly caught up in these toxic things. It doesn't matter. You can't mm-hmm. take any of this crap with you. So focus on those relationships. Be that beacon that people want to gravitate to, and then to pass on those skills to those that matter in your life, and those new family structures form around. There, I'm done my soapbox for the day, right?
So if you don't want more of this, get more of that. Buy this book right here. You like that transition right there?
Yes.
Wasn't that fun?
And see, it's not all about me.
Exactly. It's Robin's latest book, and it's available wherever books are sold. Go and check that out.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.